I'm Lex, and welcome to Crime Drama Queens.
Hey, and I'm Lily. And we're very excited to be here on a Friday morning, and we're very excited because, unlike last time, I think we actually quite like this one.
We do quite like this one. I've forgotten how much I liked this one.
Okay, good.
Not just for... Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So, dear listener, as you may remember, Lex is rather partial to Mr. Rupert Graves, depending on what character he's playing. And I'd forgotten about that. So when I said, hey, why don't we do Sherlock... Lex went, oh yeah, I like Benedict Cumberbatch. She confessed to being a Cumberbatch. And it was only when I started watching it, I was like, oh, so we have Benedict and Rupert. Having said that, it does sound like you really do like the posh boys, Benedict and Rupert.
Oh yeah, it's not great, is it? It's not a great look.
It's fine. You can't help these things.
I mean, he wasn't playing a smug English twat, so that's...
No, and I have to say, in this one, I found Mr. Graves quite appealing.
The man has range.
The man has range. And I was thinking back to the first thing I saw him in, which was in A Room with a View, when he was probably a teenager. And I think I watched it as a young teenager, and I had a massive crush on him. So I think if I rewatch it now, I'd be like, ugh. But because I was a teenager, it was fine. But he was a very handsome young man. He's still a handsome man today. It's just sometimes he's a smug English twat.
Yes, but still incredibly handsome. And we like him for that.
We like him for that. And also I'd like to acknowledge that he is the first person to appear three times in
the things that we watched. What could have... The only thing that could have made this better, Sue Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Alas, no Sue Johnson.
Maybe next time.
Maybe next time.
Okay, so do you want to, in case people are a bit confused, and haven't read the show notes at all or the title of the episode, would you like to tell everyone what we're looking at today?
Yeah, so we are looking at Sherlock. We are looking at Season 1, Episode 1, A Study in Pink. It was first broadcast on the 25th of July 2010 on BBC One. It was written by Stephen Moffat and directed by Paul McGuigan, and I'm really... I'm so pleased that you put in brackets how to pronounce McGuigan, because
I think we've tied ourselves in too many knots over the last few months. So, yeah, I Googled it to make sure, and then I put it phonetically.
When I first read it, because my reading is not great, I read it as Mad Wig Run, and I was like, that sounds like something you'd do in London. Like a 10K. A Mad Wig.
A mad wig.
There probably is one of those.
There probably is. All right. So, Lex, do you want to tell us? Oh, this is the BBC website. Yes.
Yay.
Because I had a look at IMDb, I had a look at Wikipedia, and then I had a look at the BBC page, and I thought, actually, you know, it was their show.
Yes.
Let's see what they say.
They say, a war hero invalided home from Afghanistan meets a strange but charismatic genius who is looking for a flatmate. It's London in 2010 and Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes are meeting for the first time. A string of impossible suicides has Scotland Yard baffled and only one man can help. Ooh.
Ooh. I wonder who that one man is.
I'm really glad I read the notes beforehand because the word invalided, I keep wanting to say invalidated.
But I suppose it comes from the same word, don't you? Invalid.
This is true.
Invalid.
Yeah.
Ooh.
There we go.
That makes the word invalid just sounds so awful.
It does.
You are not an invalid, you are just invalid.
Invalid. Well.
Poor Dr. Watson, he is invalid.
He is. Well, that's probably a good time for you to talk through the main detectives.
Right. So the main detectives, unsurprisingly, it's Sherlock Holmes. He's played here by Benedict Cumberbatch. He is, quote unquote, a high-functioning sociopath. That sounds fun. He plays the violin, does wacky experiments, is socially pretty unsound, and is, of course, a stone-cold genius. But I imagine he's really hard to live with. And also, he says, he explains to Dr. Watson that he is a consulting detective, one of a kind. Now, having just watched the Marlowe Murder Club, we know that the police can hire advisors anytime they want.
On a whim.
So, Sherlock, I'm sorry to break it to you, but Mrs. Potts and her crew beat you to it. Imagine that mashup.
Oh, that would be... Can you imagine, like, a sort of... Yeah, a mashup of detectives, like Sherlock Holmes and Mrs. Potts. Her naked, him with his nicotine patches.
I mean, Sherlock Holmes, he would have worked that whole plot out before even the second person was killed. In less than 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
This episode, in case you haven't watched it, is 60 minutes. No, it's 90 minutes, isn't it? It's 90 minutes. So it's half the time. It's strange because less happens and yet more happens than in the Marlowe Murder Club.
And it's also more gripping and more compelling, to be fair. Like, more happens, yes, in that there's a richer dialogue and narrative. Yes.
Okay, so
just more.
Dr. John Watson, he's the invalid army doctor. He was medically discharged after getting injured in Afghanistan. So he is Holmes's sidekick. He is the voice of reason and he's the moral compass. And just gives him, like, when Sherlock just pitches it slightly wrong, he gives him a little nudge and goes, not like that. He's quite useful. They are a bit of a yin and yang thing going on. This is their first case together and the first time they meet and they move in together.
Hmm.
Watson is working through some PTSD from his experiences in Afghanistan. And he is, at first, he is cynical and he's weary of life. And Sherlock Holmes, I think it's fair to say, does revitalize him. And they meet via a mutual friend.
Yes.
And after a brief chat to ascertain whether Watson likes the violin, they agree to meet at 221B Baker Street with an eye to moving in together. And that is actually directly out of the story. So I decided, oh, I should read. Yeah, I thought I'd read A Study in Scarlet, which is what the original story is. And it is the first time they meet. I haven't finished it because I thought it was a short story. And it is not. When they meet through a friend, Anne Holmes says, are you okay with me playing the violin? And Watson's like, are you any good? And he's like, yeah, not bad. And so it's fine.
And that's it.
And so it is one of the questions they ask. So some of it is really picked very directly from the text. Other things are not. In the book, Sherlock Holmes is a lot more sprightly and cheerful. Maybe he's just high all the time. And Watson,
he
is very much a man of few words, stoic. In the books, he's the narrator. Which means he can't be a man of few words, but he's a chatty Cathy. He's a chatty Cathy in the books.
That would be a short story.
He does go on a bit. So the characters, it's their interpretations. I suppose you're always looking at interpretations, aren't you? You're never looking at exactly. But some stuff, some bits are lifted directly from the text. So they meet at 221B Baker Street, and the landlord there is one Mrs. Hudson, who Sherlock has helped out in the past, and she's given them cheap rent. She must have basically given it to them for free, because I don't really understand what their income streams are. And it is Baker Street.
Which is very, very expensive.
Anyway, Sherlock and John are rubbing along together and they're getting to know each other. And John is impressed by Sherlock's powers of reasoning, although he's not that keen when Sherlock turns those powers on him. So Sherlock, almost immediately, he says, oh, you've been invalided out from Afghanistan. And that's also in the book, that Watson was in Afghanistan. Then he says, by the way, your limp is psychosomatic. And I think that pisses him off. But he's not wrong.
Yes.
So other detectives include D.I. Greg Lestrade, played by Lex's fave, and temporarily my fave, Rupert Graves. He is the Scotland Yard detective who grudgingly calls on Holmes for help solving crimes. He has a couple of police sidekicks who don't like Sherlock at all, and they think he's a freak. And they are almost pantomime villainy with their little things they come in and say.
Yeah, like, there's I forget what the lady's name is.
She's Donovan.
That's right. And she's just like, yeah, he's a freak, he's this. It's like kind of playground taunting. It's a little bit.
Playground taunting, yes. I think that's very accurate.
Although, admittedly, he does call her out on a couple of things. Which
again, you'd see might rankle her a bit.
He does. But it's fun, and we like it.
So, Lex, can you tell us about the crime?
Yes. I don't know why I made that sound.
Why not?
I'm very under caffeinated and underslept. So the crime is a series of murders and they all appear to be suicides. First of all, there was Sir Geoffrey Patterson, a wealthy businessman. Then the following month, an 18-year-old man called James Fillmore dies. And a couple of months after that, Beth Davenport, an MP, dies after leaving a party. There doesn't appear to be a connection between the victims, all of whom we can see poison themselves in fairly random parts of London, but they all use the same poison. Scotland Yard are investigating them as suicides that are somehow connected, but when Sherlock Holmes tells them it's murder, they bring him in to sort it out, because that's how it works. That's how it works. When the Met or whoever can't solve crimes, they just draft in any old
or somewhere else Harry. In the world can't solve crimes, then they'll draft in someone from the Met.
That's it. What we're understanding is that essentially all police forces are somehow inadequate.
They all need outside help.
Papering over the cracks with people entirely unqualified. With
absolutely no jurisdiction.
No jurisdiction, no background checks, no vetting. Just a real keen interest and a lot of time on their hands.
Because that's all it takes. That's all it takes.
A hobbyist, if you will. Anyway, sorry. That's all it takes. Also a murder board.
Yes, of course. Sorry.
You need to have adequate wall space for a murder board. But the latest body is at Lauriston Gardens, and Sherlock drags Watson to the crime scene, as he is, after all, a doctor, and could be useful. Not to a dead person, but to Sherlock. So, and then the game is afoot. Hey, we're on.
Yes. Hey.
So, Lily, the suspects, who are they?
Yeah, a bit thin on the ground because they all killed themselves. So the victims themselves are sort of the suspects. So it's a mystery.
Yeah, I must admit, I remember this. Like, the minute I started watching it, I was like, oh, I remember this one. I do remember thinking it was just incredible. I really, really liked it. But I will say, it feels like it was a really long time ago, but it isn't. But it
was.
Also feels...
So it was 2010. And then, so we think about, sorry, back to Rupert Graves. So he... he did that first Death in Paradise and he did the first Scott and Bailey, and they were both 2011. So they, all those three, it seems like we look at things in batches. So Frost,
batches
and
of
Morse,
Caroline Quentin.
And well, they were all early 90s. And then you have like Wake of the Dead, Blue Murder, that's early 2000s. And now we're looking at the 2010s, the start of the 2010s.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is... hadn't really thought of it like that. Yeah. Well, there we go. How exciting.
And then the really modern stuff, all of which we've hated so far.
And I did send you a link to something which you thought looked mad, and I thought looked mad. Yes.
So if it's mad, we're doing it.
But anyway, the investigation.
Great.
So the latest body is that of Jennifer Wilson. She's in her late 30s and she's dressed in pink. Mm-hmm. She's lying dead in an empty house. Detective Sergeant Donovan and Anderson, the forensics dude, who looks a bit creepy.
Yeah, they don't like Sherlock.
They don't like him.
And that guy often plays creepy guys.
Yeah. I think it's the hair.
Yeah.
Well, and also his
face.
Partly his face. Yeah. Anyway, just him.
Just him, sadly.
Actually. They're not pleased to see him. But then he does make them look really bad at their jobs. Yeah. So you can kind of understand it. He also points out that they're having an affair by sniffing out their deodorant.
Oh, he's like a gross sniffer dog.
Like, he was like...
You're wearing a man's deodorant. I'm a man. Yes, but Donovan's also wearing that deodorant.
Anyway, back to the body. So she was left-handed and has broken her nails scraping the letters R-A-C-H-E on the floor. Mm. Sherlock notices her clean necklace and dirty rings and deduces she's unhappily married.
Okay.
Yep. The inside of the wedding ring is clean, suggesting she takes it off a lot, so she's possibly having affairs.
Cool.
I think most of us take our wedding... Well, I
take mine off for work, anyway. So yeah. Mine's on and off all the time. Not having an affair.
She's not from London, but had only planned to stay the night. Her coat is wet and her collar had been turned up against the wind, so she's travelled in from somewhere wet and windy. After checking where has been wet and windy, Sherlock lands on Cardiff.
So obviously that must be right.
I mean, to be fair, Cardiff is a pretty good bet if you're going to ask where's wet and windy. It's always raining in Wales, is it not?
It is.
Yes, so the letters R-A-C-H-E most likely spell out the name Rachel, so they need to find this Rachel and work out the connection between her and the victim. Mm-hmm. Then he says, judging by the size of her suitcase, but she has no suitcase.
What?
I know. Sherlock has seen the splash marks on her ankle that have been caused by a wheelie suitcase. So where is the suitcase?
It's a good question.
It is a good question. So these aren't suicides, they're murders, and by accidentally holding on to the suitcase, the killer has made his first mistake. I keep getting this wrong. Is it Lestrade, Lestrade?
I know, sorry. Yeah, because I always thought in my head it was Lestrade, but they were saying Lestrade. So we're going to go with Lestrade.
Okay. Okay, so Lestrade asks what the mistake is and Sherlock shouts, pink! Is everyone keeping up? It's like Diana Quick.
Quick, Diana Quick!
Diana Quick!
Yes. We'll talk about this later, but there's a certain amount of assumptions that Sherlock makes along the way that always turn out to be correct. And I'm not sure that in real life it works that way.
And I think because he works at a kind of a momentum, no one has time to really kind of question it. Because you're like, okay, cool. All right. Yeah, fine.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he dashes away, forgets about John.
Yes.
John makes his way home, encountering some subplots on the way.
Yeah, we will cover them later in the subplot section.
Yes. So Sherlock gets John to send a text that says, "What happened at Lauriston Gardens? I must have blacked out. 22 Northumberland Street, please come." Then John notices that Sherlock has the pink suitcase that was missing. Yeah. He's a bit freaked out.
Fair enough.
And Sherlock assures him he's not the killer. He just worked out whereabouts the killer would have probably dumped the suitcase and had a look around that area. Just had an inkling.
Just had an inkling. Which, fair enough, you could have thought, okay, so he probably drove off this way, judging by blah, 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 and then he probably had to ditch it down the side street. Probably had to. But couldn't the police have also done that? Wouldn't the police have also been all right, let's have a look. But they just seem to be like, God damn it, scratching their heads and walking away and not actually doing anything.
Why didn't we think about that?
It's like in a Marlowe Murder Club when she's like, oh, Tanaka, make sure you get a list of blah, blah, blah. And Tanaka's like, thanks, Mrs. Potts. Good idea. As if she wouldn't have already done that. Sorry, we're not going to keep going back to the Marlowe. I've just been editing it, so it's just in my head. Fuck off, Mrs. Potts.
Have you got like a little counter? Oh, there's another one.
A little counter of how many times we say, oh, fuck off, Mrs. Potts.
To be fair, it makes a nice change to me shouting fuck off Joyce when about Joyce Barnaby.
Yeah. Yes.
I also sound like I'm a really bad feminist because all the people I tell to fuck off in these programmes are always women.
Sure, that's not true, but I'll have a think about it.
But
yeah, but to be fair, Joyce Barnaby and Mrs. Potts.
That's a WI meeting you wouldn't want to be part of.
And it just
anyway, she'd probably invite you to nude swimming.
Yeah, no thanks.
No thanks. Anyway,
we should probably get back. Just get back to this, right? So Sherlock has the suitcase because he worked out where the killer probably dumped it. Well done, Sherlock.
But he's realised that the phone is missing. It's not with the body, it's not in the case, so the killer must still have it, which is why he wanted John to send that text message. And then the phone rings. They don't answer it, but take it as confirmation that the killer has it.
Yeah, why did they answer the phone and be like, hello? Can I speak to the killer, please?
So they set off for Northumberland Street to see if the killer goes there too, and on the way discuss how he must abduct his victims and drive them to the scene of their deaths. How do you take someone from a busy street in broad daylight? Who do we trust, even though we don't know them? All very valid questions.
Yes.
They stop at a restaurant opposite 22 Northumberland Street so they can keep an eye out. And naturally, Sherlock knows the guy who runs the restaurant, Angelo, as he got him off of a murder charge.
Yes, he did.
We've all been there. And whilst they're in the restaurant, they spot a taxi pull up outside number 22. But as they realise that that's the guy, it drives away and they chase after it. As you did. Not sure if I saw a taxi pull away,
I'd be like, damn.
Wouldn't be chasing it. Just be like, oh, no.
Because you could get, like, the license plate, but then they think that they're chasing the passenger, aren't they? So getting the license plate of the taxi is probably not going to... They don't think would actually help them at this point.
But what is helpful is that Sherlock has the streets of London mapped out in his head.
Yes, he does.
Like a cabbie.
In his mind palace.
So they run down the back streets in his mind palace. They're running down the back streets to try and cut it off. It involves a lot of running and jumping across things. And they finally stop the cab and wrench the door open to find a guy who's just arrived at Heathrow. And he's definitely not the killer. So he looks really confused.
He looks really confused, poor guy.
And they kind of put on this whole thing about, we just wanted to welcome you to London, like, have a great time.
Yeah. Sherlock flashes a police badge. And afterwards, John's like, well, how do you have a police badge? And he's like, oh, it's Lestrade, so I just pickpocket him all the time. I've got tons of them. I think Lestrade would be getting quite a lot of trouble, wouldn't he, if he just constantly lost his police badge?
Well, Also, if you just met somebody that was like, yeah, I keep nicking a policeman's ID for shits and gigs, you'd be like, okay, you are a massive lunatic.
Yes. Yes. Big red flags.
Big red flags. We cut to a scene where Lestrade and his team are at Sherlock's flat on a drugs bust. Hey. It's a pretend drugs bust, but basically as a punishment for him finding the suitcase and not handing it over. And we get the vibe that maybe in the past Sherlock did have a bit of an issue. And he pointedly says that he's clean.
Yes.
I mean, there's a thing with him with like nicotine patches. That's meant to be his new vice, isn't it?
Yeah. He and Lestrade, don't they like... Because doesn't Lestrade also have loads of nicotine patches and they compare at some point?
Yeah, because Sherlock's got like three or something on his arm and Lestrade's got however many, and that's how they... I don't really understand. So
is that their bonding?
In the text, isn't Sherlock an opioid addict? Is that not his background?
Was it cocaine?
I don't know.
It was just normal in Victorian times, wasn't it? They were all high.
Yeah.
That's the only way you could get through.
Like in Poirot, where they're all just...
Yeah, they're all taking their tonics
taking
with strychnine.
Taking tonics.
With a harmless dose of strychnine. Okay.
So Lestrade tells Sherlock that they found Jennifer Wilson's daughter, Rachel. She was stillborn 14 years ago, so why was Jennifer using her dying moments to scratch out her name on the floor? There's an uncomfortable bit when Sherlock says, that was 14 years ago, why would she still be upset?
Yeah.
But then at least reads the room very, very quickly and realises that he's said the wrong thing.
Yes.
And...
a bit bad.
Like, I texted you about this. Like,
I think they do make him way more neurodivergent in this.
Yeah. And I can't remember. I think as the series goes on, they soften that a little bit. He's still...
Yeah, it's like the Jonathan Creek that they go in quite strong with it and then
they
soften it out. I don't really know why.
But I kind of get the whole that they want him to be...
They,
I don't know. They want him to be clinical and direct and not really thinking about other people's feelings.
Yes. But when he says stuff like that, it's maybe they're worried it doesn't come across necessarily back there. Maybe it wasn't kind of like, he's probably neurodivergent. People were just like, oh, he's a bit of a prick. Whereas I think that they can go down the the neurodivergent route without him just saying awful things all the time.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So I don't know. But I think, 2010, maybe they were just like, oh, we need to pull back on that a bit. I don't know.
Yeah. It was, he clearly does realise that he said the wrong thing very, very quickly. He's like, oh. Yeah.
Not good. And then John says, a bit not good.
A bit not good. So scratching the name would have been hard work. So what was she trying to tell them? Still more questions.
More questions.
So many questions. And Sherlock tells everyone to shut up and stop thinking. So he tries to piece it together. He sends people out the room.
Yes, Anderson has to leave the room because...
Face the wall. Yeah. Somebody else has to face a wall.
Yeah, Anderson has to go. And at some point, Anderson starts talking and he says something like, oh, shut up, Anderson. When you speak, you lower the IQ of the whole street. Or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yes.
It's very funny.
It is rather good, that. But he does. I mean, he's so awful. And he says, oh, gosh, look at your vacant little faces. Your brains must be so empty and slow. Gosh, it must be so relaxing not having a brain like mine and all the rest of it. And I thought, well, yes, you're this genius and everything. But just because I'm not a genius doesn't mean my brain is quiet. You're very welcome to come into my brain. But unfortunately, I'm not dealing with logic here. I'm dealing with, like, those...
many anxious thoughts.
Those bouncy balls which have lots of little flat sides, you can't predict which way they're going to bounce. So my brain is like a room and someone has thrown several handfuls of those balls in and they're just bouncing wildly off the walls. So it's no, Sherlock, it's not relaxing being in other people's brains. It's just...
I remember, a therapist once saying to me about anxiety, saying... it's like a train station, like you don't need to acknowledge all the trains that are there, like some of them are there for you and some of them are there for other people. And I was like, but in my brain, like, all the trains are for me. I'm running late for absolutely all of them. Some of them have come off the rails.
Or you're looking at all the trains but you can't find the boards that tells you which platform is which. You just know that your train is leaving in 3 minutes, there's 8 trains in front of you and literally no signs.
And there are strikes. There is union action everywhere.
One part of the station happens to be on fire.
But when...
for some reason, it's my problem to deal with it.
But you say that to a therapist and they look at you like you're part of the problem.
Well, that's their problem. Anyway, Sherlock tells everyone to shut up and stop thinking. So,
and then Mrs. Hudson runs in all kind of like, oh, Sherlock, your taxi's here. But Sherlock doesn't order a taxi, so he tells her to bugger off. He's like, bugger off, Mrs. Hudson. Yeah. She's quite sweet. She's quite sweet, but I would also find her quite irritating.
You wouldn't want her around all the time, no. But I think she'd make a nice cup of tea.
She would.
You always need a woman in these things to make a nice cup of tea, don't you? Not you. I'm not saying that you directly, Lex. Lex is a bad feminist. Sorry, go on.
I'm a bad feminist. I always need a woman around to make me a nice cup of tea. Please don't clip that as a standalone, no context quote.
And then Lex doesn't even make her own tea. She hires a woman to do it for her.
Quite pointedly, a woman.
A woman. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. Back to the suitcase. There was no laptop. There was no laptop in the suitcase. So she must have conducted all business on her phone. And I know that the killer has the phone. The word Rachel isn't just a word. It's a password. So Jennifer Wilson had left clues behind. When she realised she was going to die, she hid her phone inside the taxi. And as she was dying, scratched her password into the floorboards. Mm-hmm. So Sherlock concludes that her phone was a smartphone.
What's that?
And she could get her emails on
it.
What? Wow. I forgot that like 2010.
Yeah.
I remember I had a BlackBerry at my ill-fated time at another retailer that I won't remind us of, because that's how I accessed my emails on my phone. And I was like, this is just
awful.
Incredible. I mean, it's awful.
It's a work thing.
Wow.
Yes, but wow.
Work can now harass me at home and at work. Yeah. This is insane.
Yeah, I remember having to, when I changed jobs to, so I was no longer working for a big broadcasting corporation, but somewhere else. I remember having to have my phone over so they could get my emails on my phone. And I just remember sitting there going, why? But why?
Why do I need to speak to me at home?
That's not very well.
So because Jennifer could get her emails on her phone, wow, they could get her email address from her suitcase and look up her phone account online. It's got GPS, so they can track where the phone is now. They look up the phone number, enter the password, and ta-da! Where is the phone? 221B Baker Street.
So the phone is there.
How? It's all very, very exciting.
How strange.
And then Mrs. Hudson comes in again, pestering Sherlock about a taxi that's waiting for him. And then finally, the pieces fall into place. The taxi.
Yes.
So, Lily, who did it?
It was the cabbie. That's all they call him, the cabbie. That's who can hide in plain sight, hunting crowds in broad daylight, etc. The taxi driver. And he's ready to give himself up. I don't know why, but he is. And he says to Sherlock, either... you could just hand me over now. That's fine. I'll come quietly. Or Sherlock can come with him and find out exactly how and why those people died. Basically, if Sherlock just hands him over to the police, he said, you'll never find out how or why this happened. And Sherlock, being Sherlock's like, okay. The cabbie says, he didn't kill them. These people killed themselves after he talked to them. And he'll talk to Sherlock too. And Sherlock will do the same thing. So Sherlock's like, good plan. Let's go. And I go to an empty building, and the cabbie then takes out a gun, demonstrating how he got his victims to go with him in the first place. And Sherlock says, dull. And I agree, because I wanted there not to be a gun or anything like that, like physical violence involved.
Any kind of force. Yeah.
Whatever. They go inside, they sit down, and the cabbie takes out a bottle, a little bottle with a pill in it. Then he takes out another. It says one bottle has a good pill, and the other one has a bad pill. Sherlock must choose which to take, and whichever he chooses, the cabbie will take the other pill. He pushes one bottle towards him and says it's like chess. This is the first move. So Sherlock says, no, it's 50-50, it's just chance, but the cabbie insists that it's not. The cabbie reckons he is also a genius. Yeah, maybe he is, but Sherlock does his whole, like, looking him up and down and summing him up. So the cabbie has shaving foam behind his ear that nobody's pointed out to him. So clearly he lives alone. He has photos of his kids in his cab, but the mother has been cut out, which probably means that she left him and took the kids. His clothes are clean, but they're old, so he's not buying new stuff or planning for the future. And now he's on this kamikaze killing spree, so maybe he's ill, maybe he's dying. And the cabbie confirms that, yep, he has an aneurysm in his brain and any breath could be his last. But he's outlived those four people he killed, at least. Sherlock doubts that motive. He reckons it's about the children. And the cabbie confirms that, yeah, someone is paying him to kill. He has a sponsor. For every person he kills, money goes to his kids. And he's like, who? Who is your sponsor? And the cabbie says, oh, he's a fan of yours, Sherlock. He has a name that no one says. So, Voldemort. He who must not be named, one assumes at this point.
Or Macbeth.
So, the cabbie says, you have to choose. Choose your bottle, choose your pill, or he'll shoot him. And Sherlock goes, yeah, all right, fine. Yeah, I'll choose the gun. Gun, please, shoot me. Shoot me. But of course, it's not a real gun, and Sherlock knows this. So Sherlock just gets up to leave. But the cabbie asks him again to pick. And Sherlock, for some reason, does actually pick. He gets really drawn into this, and the cabbie starts manipulating him, like, who's clever, you or me? Who's going to pick the right bottle? And you have this moment where they each have a pill, and Sherlock's about to take his. The cabbie's about to take his. And then someone shoots the cabbie, like, from another building through the window. It's John Watson. He was tracking the phone on the laptop, and then he wound up in the building next door, looking through the window, seeing what was happening, and he is a crack shot and still has his gun. So Sherlock can't see who shot him. But as the cabbie's dying, Sherlock stamps on him and says, I want to know who you're working for. And the cabbie says, it's Moriarty, obviously.
Yes.
So afterwards, they come down and the police are there, and the police are trying to put blankets on Sherlock because apparently he's in shock. And he's like, why do I need a blanket? I don't need a blanket. Get off me. And Lestrade comes over and says, right, so somebody shot him. We don't know who. And of course, Sherlock starts with his whole, right, well, he shot at a distance, so he's got some kind of military experience. He's very good in stressful situations. And then he realises that it was John. So then he goes, oh, forget I said anything. I don't know. Total mystery. Total mystery who shot him. Doesn't really matter. Let's all move on with our lives. But then one of my favourite lines in the whole thing, so when they're talking and they're having a bit of a laugh, and Watson says, we can't giggle. It's a crime scene. So having a lovely little giggly moment together. We have a bit of a cheesy ending. I think just the last like couple of seconds made me go, oh well. It was fine. So we have this suspicious figure who we'll talk about in the subplots, and he's spying on Sherlock Holmes. And now he's also spying on Dr. Watson. And he says to his pretty female assistant, right, we need to up the surveillance status on those two. And then she goes, I'm sorry, up the surveillance status on who? And he goes, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson. And then there's a, and then they're sort of, you see Holmes and Watson sort of walking in slow motion, chatting with each other. That was a little bit cheesy at the end, but it's fine. I'll go with it. I don't care.
Yeah.
So the cabbie did it on behalf of Moriarty. I still have a few questions, though.
What are those questions?
Well, it's the whole, like, did we believe it thing. So at the end, they've got, Sherlock has chosen a bottle. And they are about, when Watson shoots the cabbie, Sherlock has chosen a bottle and he's about to take the pill. Did he choose the right one?
Yeah.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Was it just 50-50? And the cabbie just got lucky this whole time? We don't know.
No.
Or is it like the Princess Bride? You know, in the Princess Bride, where there's a similar thing of you need to, one of them's poison and one of them's not. Have you seen the Princess Bride?
No. I like the fact that you started and then you looked at me because I was just pulling a really blank expression. You're like, have you
here we go
watched?
Again.
No. Here we go again.
Right.
No.
So, it's right. Let's just say it's this kind of situation. What that person, the cabbie character, has done in that is he's taken like tiny bits of the poison over a big period of time and he's built up a resistance to it. Is it that both bottles have the poison, but the cabbie's built up a resistance to it somehow? But you don't find out his actual method. You don't know how he gets people to choose a certain bottle, or maybe he doesn't, and the poison doesn't have any effect on him. I'd have liked, but they never delve into any of that.
Some kind of resolution.
Yeah, I kind of wanted a bit more resolution there, but it's fine. It's okay. And the other question is, why did the cabbie give himself up? Why didn't he just carry on? Or why didn't he just if he'd just chucked the phone out the window and just carried on, that was it. The phone was their only lead.
I suppose maybe Sherlock, he likes the thrill of the...
Yeah.
Like, he likes the drama.
But why didn't he just throw the phone out of the window? I thought, well, you know, catch me now, just carry on.
Yeah, true. I don't know.
The phone was the only link that they had.
This new fandangled email phone.
Yes. That's
true. With GPS. What?
Magic phones. My other question was, earlier on, when they're going to go to Northumberland Street and they're going to sit in a restaurant and they're going to see who shows up, see if the killer is going to show up. And then the cab pulls up and they've been talking about who can hunt in broad daylight, who do we trust. When the cab pulled up, I thought, I did watch this when it first came out, so I don't know if it was like in the back of my head as a memory already that it was the cab driver. Mm. But when the cab pulled up outside, I thought they were talking about a cab driver because they've been talking about how do you abduct someone in public? I was like, oh my goodness, yes, of course, there's a cab outside, it's the cab driver. And then when they were chasing the cab, they get there and then they open the door to look at the passenger. And I was like, why are you looking at the passenger? It's the cab driver who's abducting people in broad daylight. So I don't want to be like, I got there before Sherlock, because maybe it was that deep memory of actually having watched this before. But when they were talking about it, that was the thing that jumped out at me. So I don't know why they didn't get that.
I don't.
And also, I suppose, does it matter? Because actually...
I don't think it necessarily...
When I was... because I've been editing Marlowe Mystery, whatever it was.
Fuck off, Mrs. Potts.
Yeah. And it's quite a long episode, if you've listened to it. And I'm cutting it down further. Because the thing is, there's so much that happens but doesn't really happen. So when you're going through the investigation, it's sort of like, oh, and then they do this and that's bad. And then they do this and that's bad. In this, the actual investigation is very brief. That they see the body. Sherlock works out that the cabbie must have the phone. They call the phone.
Yeah.
They look at who's showing up. Then they go back to the flat. And then that's Lestrade's there and the cabbie shows up. So the actual investigation itself is very brief. And the whole denouement takes like a good half an hour. So a third of the episode is the cabbie and Sherlock. So it's not a long investigation, but for some reason it does feel like much more happens than it actually does. And I know there are a few side plots along the way. It was very well written. The characters are really well drawn. And you feel like you're going on this adventure with them together.
I would say, like, because I don't want to, like, speak negatively about people's writing, but I do think there is something in the writing and the way that it's been, like, everything's very tight.
Everything's very tight. It's been very tightly edited. Someone had lots of fun in that editing suite doing all the split screens and everything. And they kept doing those, crash zooms or whip zooms or whatever, which reminded me a lot of... Scott and Bailey, which, as we've said, is same era, and I think that was all very fashionable at the time.
And like, I seem to remember watching Sherlock at the time and thinking, my God, this looks incredible. Yeah. But actually, if you look at it very now, stylized. It's 14 years.
Yeah.
It is very stylized, and actually, in some parts of it, like the credits, I was like, oh, actually, that looks a bit not hack,
but a bit like
a bit
14, 15 years ago of its time.
Yeah. It's still incredible.
Yeah.
Because if you think, I remember every time they brought out a Sherlock episode, there was always years between them because Martin Freeman was busy, like,
they were both
being
really busy,
the Hobbit or something. Yeah. And it was always really exciting when it came out. And I still get that kind of like whoop of excitement when I watch the credits, but it is of its era.
Of its era. And that's fine. I mean, everything is.
Yeah.
And I think that this was a really good episode. I don't remember much from the early series, but I think, you know, if again, in my imaginary free time, I might go back and watch more from the early series. Because I do remember it as it went on a bit later, some of the later ones weren't as I think they were just trying to be too clever, like, oh, and then this happens and then this happens. And actually you're like, you know, keep it simple because the characters and the dialogue are enough. You don't have to overcomplicate the plots or make it too whizzy.
The ones, I can think of one where, like, I won't say what happens, but basically, like, someone dies but doesn't die.
Yes, Reichenbach falls, yes. Which, if anyone knows the original Sherlock Holmes, they'll know what you're talking about. But in this, they had to explain that away. Which I think in original books, they were like, yeah, that didn't really happen, so let's just forget about it. But they had to explain it.
Yeah, and it's very clever. The way it's written is really, really clever. The way it's directed is very, very clever. And they're both, well, not obviously Rupert Graves and everyone, but the two main protagonists are incredible actors. Yes. So I think it's, yes, not as much happens as the Marlowe Murder Club, but just what does happen has more value.
And it's really, it upsets me that these are all men and the Marlowe Murder Club are all women.
Women.
And I find that
it sort of makes us bad feminists.
It doesn't make sense. But it is Marlowe Murder Club, which we should stop talking about because that's not what we're talking about right now. But it is, if there were splinter groups in the WI, just got a bit drunk and went off on one.
Splinter groups in the WI.
But, and then this is really cool.
When the WI goes rogue.
Yes, the WI just puts too much gin in their gin and elderflower jam or something.
The fumes.
And, but then this is proper, like, you know, stylish crime drama, and it just pisses me off a bit. We need to find something. But I mean, Scott and Bailey was brilliant, and I know, and I'm not going to get all down about this, and we're going to find other stuff. I know, but I think it's just because we did the two side by side.
I maybe step away from the thing I sent you because I suspect that I'm sure
we'll come back to it. Yes. We will come back to it.
I suspect that's not a great piece of broadcasting, considering it was cancelled after like one.
But Sue Johnston.
But Sue Johnston, I am going to make it my life's work to watch everything that Sue Johnston has ever been
in. We should probably find something with Sue Johnston to do next, just so that we can
redress the balance.
The cabbie is Phil Davis, who was, of course, in Morse. So he's now been in two.
And like, as you say, he never just plays a guy.
He never just plays a guy.
Either place. No. He's either one end of the spectrum or the other. Either really nice or just a massive arse.
Yes. So we'll find another with Phil Davis as well. So he can. So we've got Rupert Graves on three. Well done. We've got
Phil Davis on two.
It's on two and Sue Johnson on two. So let's go and find some more.
Have we got any others? There are no others?
Oh, I want to do Professor T, and that's Ben Miller again.
There must be others that have duplicated. Maybe they haven't. No others with Sean Bean. Sad.
Yeah. I'll just go watch some Sean Bean stuff anyway. It's got nothing to do with crime drama queens. That's just my hobby.
Just the entire back catalogue of Sharp.
Yeah.
I liked this. I liked this very much.
I really like this. And the subplots. Oh, we didn't talk about the subplots. So, subplots.
Oh, yes.
It's Mycroft, isn't it, is the main one?
Yes. The man that is quite creepy and spying.
So, yeah, he's really creepy. And he abducts John, basically, and asks him. He says that Holmes is his enemy or something, or his friend, or he's concerned about him. And he wants John to spy on him. And John says no.
Yep.
And he goes to see Sherlock and he's like, oh, by the way, this guy like abducted me and wanted me to spy on you for money. And Sherlock goes, oh, did you? And he said, no, I said no. And Sherlock goes, oh, well, we could have split the money. So next time, say yes. At the end, you find out that Mycroft is, of course, Sherlock's brother.
Yes.
Because...
And I quite liked that.
I quite like that. And that's Mark Gatiss, who actually...
And he plays him...
He's brilliant.
Very well.
And he could have played Sherlock Holmes as well. I reckon. Maybe not in this iteration, but he could play a version of Sherlock Holmes, I reckon, very, very well. Maybe he has. I don't know.
He's quite creepy in
a way. Yes, he does creepy very, very well. And he's done, like, Agatha Christie stuff. He adapted Agatha Christie as well. And he does a lot of, like, spooky ghost story adaptations. So I really like him. I really like his work.
He's also done League of Gentlemen.
Exactly, yes. Which, again, is probably where you get the creepy, because that was all creepy.
Yes.
And he also notices that John's walking stick and his hand tremor, because he's got PTSD tremor in his hands, and that is all, again, psychosomatic. And actually, when he's up against it and he's in very stressful situations, his hand isn't trembling. Yeah, his hand is perfectly still.
Yeah.
He is perfectly capable of walking and jumping and running and everything. So Mycroft has the same powers of deduction.
I can't remember what the line is. Something, something, the war, you miss it. Like, it's not, you're not traumatized by the war, you miss it. Because actually, because when you're in dangerous situations, that's when your hand is perfectly still. And it was very clever.
Yeah.
I liked it.
And I really like the setting up of the friendship between John and Sherlock. I think they've got such great chemistry. I really like them.
I like Mrs. Hudson. I think she's quite sweet.
And I like Mrs. Hudson. All the characters are drawn really well.
And actually, as you get through the series, Mrs. Hudson, it has some really weird threads to her character. I don't know if it's close to the text or...
I'm going to have to rewatch.
Yeah, like her husband's like... She drops these things into conversation like they're nothing, but they're quite significant things.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like drug cartels and stuff. And you're like, what? And then she just moves on. But yeah, no, when you chose it, I was like, that's when I said to you, which Sherlock is it? So when you were like, it's the Benedict one, I was like, yay! Because I've watched other versions, but this is my favourite. Yeah. And not because I'm a Cumberbatch, but because...
Of Rupert Graves, I know.
because stylistically and all of that
It's very
stuff.
Well done. I would like to go back and watch a Jeremy Brett one at some point. Just to see them side by side. I mean, very, very different. And that is much more the classic Sherlock Holmes. I remember watching it as a kid. So that'd be interesting to do a Jeremy Brett one as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I really liked it. So we better rate it.
Yes.
The highest we've gone so far is 8.5.
What was that for?
I think we did that for Blue Murder. And I think Poirot did well. And I think Endeavour did well.
I'd say... Can I say 9 or is that too high? It's probably too
high. No, I think we can go 9. I think we can go 9. I think there are questions. I wish they had dug in a bit more about, like, well, how did the cabbie manage to do that and persuade the others to take the bad pill? Or are they the bad pill? I would have kind of liked that. But, you know, you don't have to hold our hands the whole time. It doesn't matter.
I suppose because he still has the unanswered question about whether he chose the right pill or the wrong pill. And like he's got that itch he can't scratch. And so we've also got an itch we can't scratch.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's very true. It doesn't wrap up nicely for Sherlock and it doesn't wrap up nicely for us, but it's enough.
Yeah. And there are threads that carry through, if I remember. So the Moriarty thing carries through and like they don't tend to, if I remember rightly, they don't tend to wrap things up in a nice, not like a... I'm not very eloquent today, but you know what I mean.
I never am.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes. All right, 9. Well done, Sherlock. Well done, Sherlock.
Well done, Sherlock.
All you bloody men being brilliant. How annoying is that?
Maybe we should search for something. The search strings that I come up with on, like, Google, it'll be, like, female and writer and director and Sue Johnson.
Sue Johnson. I want to... Right, here we go.
What's a Venn diagram?
Sally Wainwright written anything that had Sue Johnston in it? Because that's what we need.
It's quite sad, though. Because if you think about it... Well, no, the Blue Murder was good, but there's still elements of, like... There's nothing that's, like, sharp, like a Sherlock. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've got... Like, Caroline Quentin in Blue Murder, like, they made her...
There is. I'm sure there is. We've got to... Did you ever watch... I think it's a series. We haven't really done any series yet. Bloody hell, no, I can't remember what it's called. It's that woman from The Thing.
No, I'm joking. No. The woman from... Is it Sue Johnson?
It's not Sue Johnson.
Diana Quick.
No, it's not Diana Quick.
Mariella Frostrop.
Not Mariella Frostrop.
Pam Ferris.
It's not Pam Ferris. That's it. That's all the women.
All the women.
It's not Samantha Bond, naked.
Shit. Oh, God.
Right, no, I will send you stuff.
I just want a competent woman. A competent, brilliant woman. Is the word competent really the right word, though? Competent is quite a low bar.
We should describe Sherlock as competent. You know what I like about Sherlock? He's really competent.
Do you know what? He's just... He's really capable. Like a safe pair of hands.
Oh, God. Yeah, a safe pair of hands. That's what... Oh, all right.
He can really caretake a case. Like, Yeah, maybe the word competent is not what we're looking for. That was a poor choice of words on my part.
And
I'm a bad feminist.
We are bad feminists. We like Sherlock, though.
I'm going to have that on a T-shirt.
Right.
I would just like to say I am a feminist and I endorse all women.
Scott and Bailey were brilliant.
And if Samantha Bond... If Samantha Bond wants to wild swim naked, then
just let her.
More power to her. Just let her. I'm all for it.
I'm all for it.
Just don't do it near me.